From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is host and managing editor of Daybreak Africa, James Butte. Our guest on this edition of the program is Ambassador Herman J. Cohen, commonly known as Hank Cohen, former Assistant Secretary of State for Africa under President George H.W. Bush. Our topic, Ambassador Cohen's latest book, U.S. Policy Toward Africa, Eight Decades of Realpolitik. The book is part of the Diplomats and Diplomacy series promoted by the Association for Diplomatic Studies and Training, designed to increase public knowledge and appreciation of the professionalism of U.S. diplomats and their involvement in world history. A member of the U.S. Foreign Service for 38 years, Ambassador Cohen was posted to embassies in France, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, Uganda, Zambia, and Zimbabwe. He was U.S. Ambassador to Senegal and Gambia, and as mentioned, served as Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs from 1989 to 1991. In his book, U.S. Policy Toward Africa, Ambassador Cohen draws on the documentary record and his personal experiences as a diplomat to analyze how U.S.-Africa policy has evolved through 14 U.S. administrations. Cohen takes us from Franklin D. Roosevelt in 1941 to the Trump administration, describing and analyzing the U.S. role in some of the most significant historical and political developments of the continent. The fact that the United States never had colonies in Africa may have helped it mediate between the colonial powers of Britain, France, Belgium, and Portugal, and the newly emerging African states. In addition, Ambassador Cohen tells us that over the past eight decades, the United States strived to adhere to the following values: the peaceful settlement of disputes, support for democracy, and the principle of self-determination. Since the presidency of Dwight D. Eisenhower from 1953 to 1961, the United States strived to keep the Cold War out of Africa, even though that wasn't always possible, concentrate on economic and cultural development, and safeguard the independence of African nations. Ambassador Cohen draws on several of his own personal experiences to enhance the diplomatic narrative. We learn about his briefing on Mozambique to President Ronald Reagan, in whose administration he served as Senior Director for Africa on the National Security Council staff. He advised President Reagan against supporting RENAMO, the rebel group fighting the Frelimo government. In 1989, Ambassador Cohen, then Assistant Secretary of State for Africa, tells us about his meeting with then Ethiopian head of state Mengistu Haile Mariam at the request of his Soviet counterpart. We'll ask Ambassador Cohen about the significance of that meeting and how U.S. policy was, as he says in his book, derived substantially from higher priority interests in other regions and sectors. No stranger to the VOA microphones, including our French to Africa service, Ambassador Cohen is the author of several other books, including The Mind of the African Strongman, Conversations with Dictators, Statesmen, and Father Figures, about which we interviewed him several years ago. We're delighted to welcome him back to Press Conference USA to discuss his fascinating new book, U.S. Policy Toward Africa, Eight Decades of Realpolitik. Ambassador Cohen joins us via Skype. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you very much, Carol. Thanks for inviting me.
And I'm also delighted to welcome my colleague, host of Daybreak Africa, James Butte.
Thank you very much, Carol. And Ambassador Cohen, congratulations for your book.
Thank you very much.
Indeed, congratulations. It's an excellent book. I highly recommend it to our listeners. First, Ambassador Cohen, before we get into the substance of your book, define briefly for us realpolitik, so we have a common understanding of that important term in the title.
Well, realpolitik means you keep sentiment out of your policymaking. You say, what is in the interest of the United States? We don't do things because we like somebody or we dislike somebody. We could work with them even though we dislike them. For example, President Mobutu of Zaire, Congo, we were never fond of him, but we worked with him. It's reality. It's not sentiment.
Notwithstanding your extensive expertise and experience on the continent, what did you learn in the process of researching the book, as well as what would you say is sort of the through line for U.S. policy toward Africa that remains relatively constant throughout the eight decades?
Well, I think that early on, President Eisenhower made a decision that we would not have any Cold War considerations in Africa if we could avoid it, and we should do economic development. So I think we've been very consistent. We want the Africans to make money, reduce poverty, and be able to trade with us, be our trade partners. We don't have any real strategic interests in Africa, which is good for Africa. They don't want us to be using them as a football between us and the Chinese and between us and the Russians, that sort of thing. Our main consideration is reduce poverty, promote democracy. This has been consistent through all administrations.
And before I turn to my colleague, James, like I said, you're one of the foremost experts on the continent. I remember when I worked at the African American Institute in the 1980s, your face would be on the cover of the Africa Report magazine. You did many interviews. You were quite the man of the hour. But did you learn something different, new, in doing the research for the book?
Yes, well, I think one thing that we tend to neglect in foreign policy is culture. You have to understand the culture of these other nations. We can't assume that they're just like us and they think like us. And Africans tend, I think, to consider family comes first. That's ahead of the nation in many countries, you see. And when a head of state wakes up in the morning, an African head of state, he says, how can I take care of my ethnic brothers rather than the nation? I think I may be exaggerating there, but I think there is a tendency for the cultural factors to overwhelm the national factors.
Let me turn to James for a question.
So, Ambassador, I want to take you back to chapter 15 of your book. And you write that the Trump administration's first 2 years of Africa policy could be described as a period of continuity. You and I, we spoke in November 2020, but we were talking about U.S. foreign policy. We're talking about the U.S. election and what will likely be the U.S. foreign policy, no matter who won the election. And you said that whoever wins the election or won the election, the U.S. foreign policy will be the same. I want you to explain a little bit on that, please.
If you look at President Trump's 4 years, one thing he liked to do was take anything that President Obama did before him and turn it around or cancel it. He really didn't like Obama, so he kept changing. But he didn't do that for Africa. I'm not sure why, but he kept all of the good things that Obama did. For example, Power Africa, which promotes electricity investments in Africa. Also, Feed the Future, which helps African farmers produce higher quality and greater volumes of agricultural products. He left that totally alone. In addition, he had some of his own projects. For example, he started a project called Prosper Africa. There's a whole bureaucracy devoted to that in the U.S. government, which is designed to find opportunities for U.S. investors in Africa. And I think he's making some progress there. And he sent his first ambassador to the UN, Governor Nikki Haley. He said, go to Africa and see what good things you can do. And he went to the Congo, the Democratic Republic of Congo. She went, and she persuaded the then President Kabila that he could not be president for life. He had to have an election. He had already delayed the election for 2 years, persuaded him to have an election. The election went ahead, and he ended up being out of power. I thought that was a major contribution to democracy. So I have a lot of disagreements with President Trump on a lot of issues, but I do not disagree with what he did in Africa. I thought it was very positive.
So, Ambassador, you write in chapter one that the United States has been a colonial power, but never in Africa. You know, I'm from Liberia, and one of the famous lines in Liberian history books is that Liberia was founded by the American Colonization Society. Why did the United States refrain from establishing colonies in Africa? And how do you square this with Liberian history?
Well, the main reason is an element of geography. The U.S. began on the East Coast, the first 13 colonies of the U.K. When they became independent, they had this vast territory to the west. And Thomas Jefferson, the third president, he went to see Napoleon, and he said, you have this vast territory in the Mississippi region. You're not going to be able to settle it. Why don't you sell it to us? So he sold it to the United States for $25 million, which was a lot of money in those days. And that vast territory belonged to us. So Americans looking to expand, to go to new places, they had a choice. Should they go to Africa? At that time, Africa was being colonized, the early 1800s. A lot of British people, French people were going to Africa. So the Americans said, we prefer to go west in the United States. And they had some experience with Africa. There were missionaries from Louisiana who had gone to Angola early on in the late 1700s. And they wrote back saying, this is very difficult. We're dying of disease. And we call it the white man's grave. So this told the Americans, if you want to expand, you want to have new territory, new farmland, go to the West. Don't go to Africa. That was why we never had colonies. Now, Liberia, of course, as you know, was a separate story. During the period of James Madison, there were people saying, former slaves will not get along well in the United States. We're happy that they're not slaves anymore, but they are not compatible with the American way of life. So let's give them an opportunity to go back to the land of their ancestors in Africa. So that was the beginning of the colonization of Liberia.
So Ambassador Cohen, so in chapter 11, you discussed Samuel K. Doe, the military leader then of Liberia. You discussed him and the coup and the assassination of President William R. Talbert. And you mentioned that the coming of Charles Taylor's rebel movement was a revenge for President Wufuwe Boigny of Cote d'Ivoire for the killing of A.B. Talbert, President Talbert's son, and his wife, Daisy. I think she was from Ivory Coast. Could you elaborate on this? And did the United States have prior knowledge to Charles Taylor going to Liberia to start the rebel movement?
Charles Taylor came to the United States after being head of general services in Liberia. He was about to be pursued for corruption in Liberia, so he escaped and went to the U.S. He was in Massachusetts. And Liberia demanded his extradition because they were charging him with corruption. And so the state of Massachusetts did what they were supposed to do. They arrested him, put him in prison, and they said to Liberia, send us the extradition papers. Because before we can send them back to Liberia, we need to go to court and persuade a judge. But the Liberian government delayed and delayed and did not. So Charles Taylor was tired of being in prison. So he escaped from prison and found his way back to Africa. And he went to Ghana. And from Ghana, he was recruited by Gaddafi to go to Liberia to start a rebellion force to go back to Liberia.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. Our guest is Ambassador Herman Cohen, former Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs. And we're talking about his most recent book, U.S. Policy Toward Africa, Eight Decades of Realpolitik. I'm Carol Castiel, along with host and managing editor of Daybreak Africa, James Butte. This is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel, VOA. Well, here's a shout out to a loyal fan from Nigeria, Nima Batali. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. So back to Ambassador Cohen. So much to talk about, Ambassador. I was wondering, what do you consider the most challenging decade or maybe administration for the United States in Africa?
Well, I would say there were these major wars going on. When I became Assistant Secretary of State in 1989, there were three major wars going on. It was Ethiopia was battling Eritrea secession, Angola. There were three guerrilla groups. After Portugal gave them independence, there were three guerrilla groups fighting for power. And in Mozambique, after independence from Portugal, the government was fighting another rebel group called RENAMO. And these wars were very bad because there was no agriculture going on. There was tens of thousands of refugees going into neighboring countries. It was costing lots of money and lots of lives. So I went to see Secretary of State James Baker at the time. I said, unless we can do something about these wars, we're never going to get anywhere with economic development or poverty reduction. Secretary Baker was reluctant at first. He said, well, they're really not our problems. They're really African problems. Should we get involved? So I said, I was sorry to hear that. But 1 month later, President Bush met with the president of Soviet Union, Gorbachev. And President Bush said, is there anything we can do to help you? And Gorbachev said, yes, there is three major wars going on in Africa, and we are involved in all of them. We're supporting the government of Ethiopia. We're supporting the government of Angola. It's costing us lots of money. We're supporting Cuban troops in Angola. We're spending $1 billion in each country. We can't afford that anymore. President Bush, can you help us get out of these wars? So then Secretary Baker called me and he said, that idea you had, Assistant Secretary Cohen, to do something about those wars, well, now you can go ahead and do it, you see, because there was a higher level, there was another level of interest that was U.S.-Soviet relations that played a role. So sometimes you don't know when things are going to happen to make you change your policy.
Exactly. In fact, you refer to that in the book when you say that during those years that our Africa policy was derived from higher priority interests in other regions. And that's, I guess you were referring to that, Soviet. And that's fascinating. And you played a very important role. I'd like you to talk about the significance of your meeting with then head of state Mengistu Haile Mariam of Ethiopia at the behest of the Soviets, no less, and how that led to the London conference in 1991, which achieved apparently a win-win for the United States, the Soviets, and Ethiopia and Eritrea.
Well, when I visited Mengistu, he had already been informed by the Soviets that he can no longer expect to get aid from them. And he knew without the arms that they were sending him and the Soviet advisors, that would be very hard for him to continue this war against the Eritrean secessionists and the Tigray guerrilla fighters. So he knew something had to change. He welcomed me, even though we had very bad relations with Ethiopia. We only had a charge d'affaires. We did not have an ambassador. But he said, I welcome you to start trying to bring peace to Ethiopia and let me know what I can do for you. So then I said to him, well, what you need is a mediator, especially with Eritrea. And he said, can you recommend somebody? And I said, why don't you try Jimmy Carter, former President Carter? He's been doing that, and he's a very good mediator. So that's exactly what they did, called on President Carter, who spent several months mediating this. But it was not successful because the Eritreans did not feel comfortable with him. For some reason, there was no good chemistry. So they went back to Mengistu and said, we can't do this with Jimmy Carter. And they both agreed to call on State Department to be the mediator, which meant me. So I took over the mediation. And something very extraordinary happened as soon as I did that. This was in late 1990. And as soon as I did that, the Ethiopian army, which had been very successful over 30 years in keeping the guerrillas in their mountain hideouts, the Ethiopian army suddenly started to lose the war. They started to fall back toward the capital city while the guerrillas from Tigray and Eritrea started advancing toward the capital city. It was very strange. And by June of 1991, the Tigrayan rebels had already entered the capital and the war was essentially over. So then they asked me to set up a conference that would really end the war. That led to the London conference, May 1991, where we reached an agreement that Eritrea would get its independence within 3 years. And the Tigrayans, who had taken over the capital city, would start a process of democracy in Ethiopia. So I consider that a very, very strong victory for the United States.
Following up on that, I'd like to get your reflections on the current situation in Ethiopia, where these same Tigrayan rebels are pressing for greater independence, given the assumption of power under President Abiy Ahmed, the current president. He won a Nobel Peace Prize for breaking the stalemate between Ethiopia and Eritrea, opening the way for normalization of relations after 18 years. But what do you make now of Abiy Ahmed's decision to attack the Tigray People's Liberation Front in the Tigray region, which has induced a humanitarian disaster? We have refugees fleeing to Sudan, which is already a fragile democracy. Do you think Ethiopia is on the brink of breaking up? How do you see the situation?
Well, the situation is quite serious there. I mentioned earlier that the Tigrayan People's Liberation Front took over Addis Ababa in June of 1991, and they promised to set up a process of democratization, but it never happened. What they did is took over the entire government of Ethiopia, set up a fake federal system, but ruled all the other states by themselves. It was really a one-party dictatorship under the Tigrayan People's Liberation Front. And they ruled for 29 years. And it was quite a corrupt system. They not only had control of the economy, they controlled just about everything. And in 2018, the people of Ethiopia got fed up with it. There was popular uprisings throughout the country, and the TPLF regime was overthrown. And the person who came out on top was the current prime minister, Abiy Ahmed. And he started to govern, but he saw pretty soon that he could not control the Tigrayans. The Tigrayans wanted to run their own show in their home province of Tigray, and he didn't approve of that. And he asked them to stop, but the Tigrayans did not. They went ahead, had an election, and in effect said, we're a quasi-independent people. But Abiy Ahmed didn't accept that, and he said, unless you back down, we're going to attack you. They refused to back down, so he's using armed forces now to conquer the Tigrayan People's Liberation Front, who had been in power for 29 years.
And just quickly, do you think that Ethiopia is on the brink of a breakup because there are other ethnic tensions in the country?
Yes, the people of Oromia. You know, the Oromians are the largest ethnic group in all of Ethiopia, and they're already agitating. They want more freedom. The way I see it, Abiy Ahmed wants to do like every other head of state previous to him, is to have absolute power over all of Ethiopia. I call it the Menelik complex. You know, the first emperor of Ethiopia was named Menelik the First.
Yeah.
He was the son of King Solomon and Queen Sheba. And every emperor since then wanted absolute power. And Abiy Ahmed, in my view, is, I would say, Menelik the Tenth. Has absolute power. And I think he's going to get it. I think the other provinces, after seeing what he's doing in Tigray, using strong military force, they're not going to rebel against him. I think they're going to have to live with him.
All right. All right. Over to you, James.
Well, thank you. If Prime Minister Ahmed accepts that title you gave him, that would be a quick ascension to power. Right? So I wanted you to comment because there are some major elections that have taken place or are going to be taking place in Africa. We saw the elections in Guinea, so election in Cote d'Ivoire, in Guinea and Cote d'Ivoire, where the two presidents, Alpha Condé in Guinea and Ouattara in Ivory Coast, have said to have changed their constitutions to continue on in power. We have elections coming up next year in Uganda. Comment for us, Ambassador Cohen, what is the trend? How do you see U.S. role as Africa charts its course through these elections?
Well, looking at Guinea, Cote d'Ivoire, and Uganda, I do not see democracy at work. If the Constitution was originally amended to say no more than two terms in Guinea and Cote d'Ivoire, the president in power, when that happened, when the Constitution was changed, should not then change the Constitution to benefit himself. He says, oh, I want a third term. But you can't have a third term. The Constitution doesn't allow it. Okay, let's change the Constitution. That is not democracy. That is undemocratic. And it's unfortunately that they went ahead and did that. And of course, because of strong opposition in Cote d'Ivoire, I think only 20% of the people voted. I don't call that a free and fair election. And in Guinea, I think an effort was made to caused the leading opposition candidate, Mr. Diallo, not to be able to win. I think that was a flawed election. So I do not see democracy. Now in Uganda, but President Museveni, I think he's been in power now for 30 years. What he's doing is having an election, but not allowing the opposition to function. If they have rallies, they're all arrested. And the leading candidate, Bobby Wine, has been in prison. I do not see that as a free and fair election. So the bottom line for all of these is, these old men in power do not want to leave. They should turn it over to the younger generation now. Diallo in Guinea is a younger generation. I know Konan Beje in Cote d'Ivoire is an old man, and he was running. He personally told me he wants younger people to come to power. So that is the key issue in Africa right now, at least in West Africa. It's generational change. The older people are not leaving. They must leave and turn it over to the younger generation that is really going to do good things for Africa.
So what do you think should be the role of the United States? In the past, United States used to be kind of the referee to make sure that the African leaders adhere to democratic principles. What do you think United States should do?
Well, I think that one thing that I disagreed with on the Trump administration and his policy toward Africa, which was his policy toward the whole world, which was isolationism. He said the U.S. should not be getting involved with the politics of other countries. So let them do what they want. So with respect to these three countries, Guinea, Uganda, and Cote d'Ivoire, we did nothing. Even look at Rwanda when they had an election where President Kagame won with 98% of the vote. Now, in any free and fair election, nobody can get 98% of the vote. That's impossible. So what did the United States say? good friend of ours, President Kilkami, one of our best friends in Africa, he said, "We are disappointed. We are disappointed." Well, that's not a very strong reaction. So I'd say one of my recommendations to the Biden administration is to be more forceful in promoting free and fair elections and not to accept these fake elections that we're seeing now.
That's an interesting point that you make, Ambassador Cohen, because some critics would say also about Mr. Trump that he has abandoned this promotion of democracy. We're also having problems here in the United States, some say, with respect to upholding the principle of democracy. And we've heard Mr. Trump and others vilify the role of the press. I don't imagine that helps either.
I agree with you. Those are very undemocratic practices.
Let me just quickly ask you also, quickly, we're seeing the rise of Al-Qaeda, its affiliates, so-called Islamic State, you know, in Mali and in other Sahelian areas. Of course, we have the Boko Haram in Nigeria. Now we're seeing an insurgency in northern Mozambique, where there's a lot of gas, the profits of which don't seem to be seeping down into the local population. Now we're seeing Ethiopia on the brink, the pandemic just compounding the problems. What worries you most about the current basket of problems that the continent is enduring?
Well, where you're seeing guerrilla fighters, insurgents who call themselves Islamic jihadists, and they report to ISIS or to Al-Qaeda, what we're forgetting is the socioeconomic aspects of it. There's a tendency to say, well, why is this happening in northern Mali? Why is it happening in Burkina Faso? Because the areas where this is happening, the people have been totally neglected by the central governments. There's great poverty. There are very little government programs in these areas. They have programs in the capital cities, in Niamey and in Ouagadougou or Bamako. But there's very little happening in the northern part and in the Sahel, real Sahel region. So when these jihadists come, and many of them are from Algeria, these jihadist leaders, they come and say, "Join us, we'll get you all good things." Well, they have a tendency to go along, especially the young men who have no jobs and that sort of thing. So my message to President Biden-elect, sure, we should help the French. We should help these governments fight these jihadists. But do not forget the socioeconomic aspects. We must provide aid. We must provide agriculture. We must provide running water for these neglected areas. Otherwise, the jihadist insurgency will never stop.
Ambassador Cohen, you talk about what you call the persistence of white minority rule in South Africa, Southwest Africa, and the Portuguese colonies. And then you mentioned something called U.S. policy dilemma, to protect U.S. interests or support African liberation. Please elaborate on that.
That's true. Well, when the African countries became independent, I think most of them had became independent by 1965. And they said, our highest priority is to liberate our brethren in Southern Africa, South Africa, Southwest Africa, Namibia, Angola, Mozambique, and Southern Rhodesia. But the U.S. was not very enthusiastic about that because the South Africans, for example, were strong allies in World War II. They sent their army to fight with us in Western Europe, and we had business interests there. In 1960, our investments in South Africa were already $2 billion. That was a lot of money in 1960. It's probably like $200 billion right now. And in Rhodesia, we had the chrome. There was no other source of chrome than Rhodesia. So there were a lot of interest there. And in Angola, there was a lot of oil. And the biggest investor in Angola was an American company, Chevron. So we were reluctant to take any action. But in 1975, Secretary of State Kissinger said, things are going to harm us inside the U.S. There's more and more people speaking out about white rule in Southern Africa. They want us to do something about it. There are demonstrations all over the United States, Sunday sermons in church against white rule in Southern Africa. We better do something. So Kissinger called the president of South Africa, John Foster, and he had a meeting with him in Geneva. And he said, you control Southern Rhodesia. You should bring them to independence and black majority rule. 1975 was the beginning, and the end was 1990 when apartheid ended. And the beginning was started by Kissinger, and I give him credit for that.
The book, U.S. Policy Toward Africa, 8 Decades of Realpolitik. And of course, the author is the one and only Ambassador Hank Cohen. Ambassador Cohen, congratulations again on another informative book. And thanks for taking time to talk with James and me.
Oh, you're most welcome.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Gary Jaffe and Rick Pantaleo. Joining me on the program was James Buddy, host and managing editor of Daybreak Africa. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.